You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, these days, more investors are getting into day trading to take advantage of market downturns instead of watching helplessly from the sidelines. The problem? Day trading can be risky, and trading the downside can be confusing. But binary options on Nadex let you day trade with risk protection built in. You decide your maximum risk and reward, and you can never lose more. And trading downturns is just as easy as trading rallies. Try day trading for yourself on the first and largest American binary options exchange. Trade stock indexes, commodities, forex, even economic numbers. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. That's Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Entrepreneur Eric Ries's 2011 book, The Lean Startup, was a New York Times bestseller with over 1 million copies sold, and it's been translated into more than 30 languages. His Lean Startup methodology has become a global movement in business practiced by individuals and companies around the world. In The Lean Startup, he laid out the practices of successful startups, building a minimal viable product, customer-focused and scientific testing based on a build, measure, learn method of continuous innovation, and deciding whether to persevere or pivot. Now in his latest book, The Startup Way, he turns his attention to an entirely new group of organizations. Established enterprises like GE, where he helped found their FastWorks program, tech titans like Amazon and Facebook, and the next generation of Silicon Valley upstarts like Airbnb and Twilio. Drawing on his experiences over the past 5 years working with these organizations, as well as nonprofits, NGOs, and governments, Ries lays out a system of entrepreneurial management that leads organizations of all sizes and from every industry to sustainable growth and long-term impact. Today, Eric Ries joins me on the podcast to talk about the startup way and how old companies and new companies are strikingly similar in most of the ways that really count. He recalls his own crash course in entrepreneurship, what went wrong with his very first tech venture, and why having a failed startup under your belt is something of a rite of passage in Silicon Valley. He discusses the growing pains that startups often experience and how sometimes their biggest problem is that they simply never plan for success. He discusses how he helped form the innovative FastWorks program at the granddaddy of all legacy companies, General Electric, and how a more entrepreneurial system can improve the bottom line for everything from large multinational corporations to government bureaucracies. Coming up with The Lean Startup's Eric Ries in just a moment. Eric Ries's first book, The Lean Startup, became a bestseller and a seminal business strategy guide, selling over 1 million copies and having been translated into more than 30 languages. Now Eric Ries is following it up with a new book that applies his lean startup ideas to much bigger companies and organizations. It's called The Startup Way: How Modern Companies Use Entrepreneurial Management to Transform Culture and Drive Long-Term Growth. Eric, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I enjoyed the book, and like I said in the intro, the lean startup has really grown into a worldwide movement, and it's earned you a reputation as the entrepreneur's entrepreneur. But you didn't come from a business background, apparently. You started off as a software engineer, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So what was your first crash course in entrepreneurship then?
I learned the hard way. And you're right. If you have a stereotypical image of a kid that was growing up programming computers in their parents' basement, that was me to a T.
Yeah.
One of the happiest days of my childhood when I found out you could get paid for programming. I had no idea. I just thought it was something, you know, people did because it was the most fun thing you could do. And I love technology from an early age. And I never had a business aspiration or thought of myself as an entrepreneur, but I was in college during the dot-com bubble. And, you know, by the time the dot-com bubble got to me, it was pretty far advanced. So everyone was starting a company and everyone who knew about technology was getting rich doing it. It just was a very intoxicating time. And I felt like this seemed like it would be a really fun way to be able to have a lot of impact with technology really quickly instead of having to like rise up the ranks of an established company.
Mm-hmm.
So I jumped in with both feet. And if you've seen the movie The Social Network, I had roughly the first half of the movie experience, you know, like not the part where we made any money, but all the part where we dropped out of school and invited our friends to have awesome parties and program constantly and use those funny whiteboard markers on the windows and whatever. Like, you know, just like the atmospherics of that movie are a little too close to home from my recollection. And when the dot-com bubble crashed, we were toast. I mean, we didn't mm-hmm. have any clue what we were doing. And that was that. And, you know, unlike in the movies, in real life, when you start a company, more often than not, you have to go back to those people who said, you know, you'd never make it and it was a bad idea and say, you were right. You know, yeah. You don't get that satisfaction. In the movie, you get the satisfaction of, see, suckers, I told you. This is it. No. In real life, you say, oh, no, I guess I should have stayed in school and whatever. So yeah, that was my very hard luck introduction to entrepreneurship and how hard it can be.
So during your baptism of fire in Silicon Valley, what did you learn in that process early on about entrepreneurship?
So I was not in Silicon Valley when I failed the first time.
Okay.
I went to school on the East Coast. And then in 2001, I guess, roughly that time, I came out to Silicon Valley. I was applying for jobs. And one of the most remarkable things happened that I didn't at the time understand at all. I was really embarrassed that I had failed so colossally with this startup. And I felt like my career was going to be over and people would shame me. And, you know, it was a humiliating thing to do. And I kept meeting people in Silicon Valley who would say, tell me about your failed startup. And I'd be like, oh, well, you know, I tried to like hide. They'd be like, no, it's okay. We've all failed. It's no big deal. Tell me what you learned from it. And I remember one guy who I ultimately wound up doing a lot of work with later. He said to me, don't be embarrassed from my point of view. This was a very expensive lesson that you learned on somebody else's dime. So now that I know that you're not going to make those mistakes again, that makes you a very valuable commodity in my startup compared to people who've never made those kind of mistakes and who still mm-hmm. have the arrogance to think they know all the answers. So it was one of those real Silicon Valley moments when I really understood people have a very different understanding of what failure means there, and they could see the success, the learning and the benefit of my experience in a way that I even really could not.
Yeah, and that gets into some things that come into the lean startup way of doing business, among other things, mm-hmm. not being afraid of failure and at least getting some kind of long-term benefits out of failure and experimentation.
Yeah.
For anyone who's never read the original book, The Lean Startup, if you don't mind, walk us through the basics of the lean startup way of doing things.
Sure. So the word lean in lean startup comes from lean manufacturing. So it's mm-hmm. it's not about being cheap. It's not about having, you know,
right.
crappy
Japanese
office furniture.
Concept,
it's a Japanese concept about working more efficiently through concepts like superior cycle time, engaging with customers early, and a more scientific kind of decision making. But whereas lean manufacturing has tended to be about how to more efficiently produce physical objects mostly when we already know what the customer wants, lean startup is about how do we use concepts like that in a situation where we're not entirely sure what's going to work? What does the customer really want? So we accept the extreme uncertainty that is kind of the natural soil where startups thrive and try to build a management system that works there. So for example, of our most famous concepts in lean startup, one is the minimum viable product or MVP. Mm-hmm. The idea being that rather than try to build the perfect product for everybody, let's figure out who's the early adopter going to be, build a simple, stripped down, de-scoped product just for that purpose in order to learn as quickly as possible. And then don't just do that one time. try to iterate on that product quickly through what we call the build, measure, learn feedback loop to try to get feedback and understanding about which aspects of the product are right or wrong, ultimately leading to a pivot. That's maybe our most infamous piece of business jargon. The pivot is a change in strategy without a change in vision. So how do we stay true to the original vision of why we got into this business in the first place while also acknowledging that because of the extreme uncertainty, you know, that's intrinsic to doing a startup, the odds that we got everything right in the original business plan are pretty low. So let's, instead of treating that like a failure that should be embarrassing, and instead of doing what I did in my early companies, which is allow errors in strategy to destroy the company, instead, as quickly as possible, find those errors and correct them so that ultimately we can get closer to a strategy that can work.
And this idea of the minimum viable product is interesting to me because I have to think that it completely goes against a lot of thinking that's been deeply entrenched for probably decades. You know, you want to really work at it and get the product perfect before you put it out there. Is this kind of, I guess, an adjustment to the pace at which things are changing right now? That
yes.
If you allow the perfect to be the enemy of the good, you might miss your window?
You got it exactly. That's I couldn't have said it better myself. It is extremely counterintuitive, actually, for people who have been trained, especially in engineering. But in most functional disciplines, we have a sense of what excellence looks like, and we've all been taught to strive for excellence. And there's nothing wrong with that. The question is, what is the best path to get to an excellent outcome? And the problem is that when we're trying to do something truly new, you know, a disruptive technology, something that's never been before, but also like in the book, I talk about some examples where we're not building a new technology. We're taking an existing product into a new market. There's a crazy story in the book about a team that's trying to sell healthcare equipment in post-war Iraq. So the playbook of what to do in that situation, there can be no playbook. The situation is highly, highly uncertain. But also some situations that we might not normally consider startup situations, as I'm sure we'll get to. In any of those situations, we have to accept that sitting in our own office and thinking great thoughts and being perfectionistic is not actually a very good strategy for getting to a perfect outcome. So it's not that we're not striving for excellence. It's that we have the humility and the kind of scientific mindset to accept that we got a hypothesis here. We have a theory about what customers might want, but it behooves us to go find out if that's what they actually want and let reality help us discover what's going to work.
Now, your first book, The Lean Startup, was really geared toward young startups, more in the aspirational phase. But this new book argues that the same principles can be applied as companies mature. And you say that one common problem, apparently, is that during that transition, many startups simply fail to plan for success. Is that something you've seen a lot of in the companies you work with?
It's a remarkable thing to observe because in a startup situation, when we get to what we call product market fit, that kind of inflection point where all of a sudden you're not getting customers like one at a time, but it becomes an avalanche of success. And you're seeing it now, you know, obviously you have the Facebooks and the Google that went through it before, but you have companies that are going through it, you know, right now, like Airbnb and Dropbox and, you know, you name it. These are companies that in a short period of time will often go from tens of employees to hundreds to thousands. You know, I was with a company the other day that I think they went from 100 to 1,000 employees like in 18 months. I mean, it was just a crazy scale up. So you have the tremendous stress and strain on the company. And one of the hardest things to do when you go through that transition is to both professionalize, so you avoid the kind of, you know, HR and just basic screw-ups that you've seen in some recent high-profile scandals, but to do that without losing the startup DNA. So you don't just become another big company. And I, like many entrepreneurs, I hated big companies. I didn't want to work in a big company. That was my original idea of going and becoming an entrepreneur in the first place, was to try and create something new. I didn't have to deal with the bureaucracy and the politics. And I meet so many entrepreneurs now where I tell them, listen, if you hate big companies so much, why are you trying to create a new one? And they, you know, it's like such
that is the goal, right?
Right, that's the goal. We forget that people talk about startups like they're small companies, but only the failed ones, right? The successful startups grow. That's kind of what they do. I mean, Paul Graham, one of the, you know, startup experts in Silicon Valley, he wrote an essay, a very famous essay called Startup Equals Growth. That's the title of the essay. I mean, it's very clear. That's what it's supposed to do. So that means we have to make a plan for what it's going to look like. And yet, I often will do like a town hall meeting for a company that's grown past a few hundred employees, and we'll talk about the startup DNA issue. And I'll often say, okay, raise your hand if you joined the company in the last 18 months. And almost everybody in the room raises their hand. And it's, okay, now raise your hand if you remember when this company was an underdog and when it wasn't clear if it was going to work out. And like, you know, six people raise their hands. She's like, the vast majority of people at this high growth young company, what were they doing before? Mm-hmm. What was their previous job? Probably they weren't the founders of a hyper growth startup. They were working at a big company. And so they bring with them a lot of cultural habits and assumptions and beliefs about management from a different context. And if we don't proactively create what I call a management system for continuous innovation, that startup DNA, that spark just kind of goes out of the company. And I meet with a lot of founders who don't really understand why that happened. And part of the message of the book is to tell them, you got to be ready for this.
Now, do you see a lot of overlap between the problems and goals of these young startups and more established companies or even legacy companies?
Nobody believes me when I say this. I mean, it's one of these hard things to really believe. And listen, I wouldn't have believed it myself, except that I started seeing it with my own eyes. So the Lean Startup came out in 2011. So that's just about 6 years ago. And in the intervening time, I've had the privilege of working with a bunch of these hyper-growth companies that have scaled past product market fit, as well as a number of legacy companies who have called me up and say, hey, we want to reinvigorate our company with the startup DNA and recapture it. And, you know, even though Thomas Edison is long dead, you know, we still want to see ourselves as, you know, the inheritors of his legacy, and we want to work in a more entrepreneurial way. And I think mostly policymakers and large companies and even a number of governments and nonprofits, they've kind of gotten the memo that the 21st century is going to be the world, you know, the century of entrepreneurship and innovation. Anyone who can't operate at that level of intensity and speed is in trouble. And so I would often have be working in these two different contexts at the same time. Sometimes, I mean, literally the same day, I'd be with a startup in the morning and a legacy company in the afternoon. I talk in the book a little bit about, yeah, like sometimes with the CEOs of those two companies, like sitting with Jeff Lawson, the CEO of Twilio, I think 600 employees, in the morning and the afternoon with Jeff Immelt, the CEO of GE with 300,000 employees, and trying to have these conversations. And what was bizarre to me is we're having the same conversation.
Yeah.
5-year-old company, 100-year-old company, thousands of employees, hundreds of thousands of employees, the same basic conversation. And eventually I started to realize the reason we're having the same conversation is these companies' org chart, their structures look exactly the same, even though they're 5 years old and 100 years old. And then I was like, and they're not only the same with each other. If I could reincarnate the ghost of Alfred Sloan, you know, the legendary CEO of GM who took over in, I think, the 1920s and had the fundamental breakthroughs that led to the modern matrix-managed, multi-division, multi-product company. If I showed him these org charts, he would say, oh, yeah, that looks very familiar to me. I was like, you know, I see you've made some improvements and refinements, but it's basically the same structure. And it hit me one day. We are building these new, hot, modern companies to a very old-fashioned blueprint. Mm-hmm. And is that really the best we can do? And, you know, hasn't a lot changed in the past 100 years? And do we have, you know, did anyone have any ideas for how to do better? And that seed of an idea to say, wait, that's kind of a shame that we build these new companies to old ideas. What would it look like to do better? Mm-hmm. That's ultimately what led to the startup way.
Yeah, and what's interesting is you're not even necessarily married to your own strategies, because you say this shouldn't be a one-time restructuring, what you're proposing here. New organizational models should constantly be disrupting and replacing each other in the same way that tech is rapidly and constantly evolving and reinventing itself.
Yeah.
How does one build the engine that drives that evolution and keeps it sustained?
Thank you for asking about that, because it's by far the most controversial idea in the book. But to me, it's just common sense. I mean, first of all, come on. What are the odds that I've written the last business book? You know, I feel like every business so-called guru is just like, if you just follow my one prescription, everything will be fine for you forever. And it's like, come on, who believes that? That's just preposterous to me. Of course, like the weirdness we've seen in the 21st century, we ain't seen nothing yet. The pace of change that we have experienced in our lifetime to date is the slowest pace of change we will ever experience. And because of exponential growth, this is going to get so weird. We're going to look back at this at the golden days of stability and calm. And I mean, for better and for worse, it's going to be a wild ride. So how could we possibly be so arrogant as to think we've figured out all the answers? That's crazy. But that's not an excuse for complacency. We have to start to say, how do we build a management system that can plant the seeds of its own evolution so that we can always be experimenting with new organizational forms? And I think I say in the book that The managers of the future are going to view organizational forms as basically disposable, the same way you feel about your smartphone. Like, it's state of the art when you buy it. But, you know, some people like to upgrade every 1 year. Some people upgrade every 2 years. Some people like to cling to that thing till it dies. But, like, after a few years, it's old and obsolete. That's the pace of technological change. Well, that's going to become the pace of managerial change too. So we can't just do the kind of 20th century big rearrange the deck chairs type reorgs. Those are too slow and bureaucratic to work. What we have to do is see organizational forms as something that need to be incubated and tested and experimented like a startup. And in fact, I try to present in the book a theory of a unified theory of entrepreneurship, meaning that today in the org chart, we have lots of different behaviors and activities that are managed separately that I think have more in common than people think. You know, not just high uncertainty things like a new product or a new market, but also internal systems like IT and HR. When we do radical changes in our functional domains, that should be treated like a startup too. And so too with transforming the organization. So if you look at the people who drove the transformation at GE called FastWorks or the transformation at Intuit called Design for Delight, I've worked very closely with those people. They really feel and talk like founders of a startup. They had a long, flat part of the hockey stick where they were totally misunderstood, and then they were able to do this really dramatic step change, you know, to radically change the organization. I mean, in this course of 6 months at GE, we trained all of the CEOs of all of their businesses, all of their direct reports, and every executive at the highest executive band and above. It's like the top 5,000 managers in a very short time had to go through a very intensive training and made very radical changes to the company structure that before that would have seemed impossible. And that's what exponential growth looks like. So, you know, and I tell a story in the book about people who did that in the federal government, like, you know, one of my heroes, the former CTO of the United States named Todd Park. That pattern is very similar to the product market fit, you know, hyper growth startup pattern. So trying to see those commonalities and see all of those different activities as having a deep structural similarity, that's kind of one of the breakthrough ideas in the book that I'm excited about.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Eric Ries when we come back in just a moment. Folks, I want to tell you about a terrific company I've been using for 2 years now, and I'm thrilled to finally have them as an advertiser on the show. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, you need to know about Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you run your business from your cell phone while keeping your business and personal lives separate. Choose from Grasshopper's huge inventory of local, toll-free, or vanity toll-free numbers. Simply forward your new number to your mobile phone and start taking calls immediately. Whether you're in an office, in your car, or out shopping for the holidays, Grasshopper's iPhone and Android apps help you stay connected to your customers. Not to mention, you can send and receive calls and texts from your business phone number, set up multiple extensions for everyone on your team, get your voicemails transcribed and emailed to you, work from anywhere with call forwarding to make and receive calls from your computer via the desktop app, and even utilize Wi-Fi calling. Better yet, Grasshopper offers an easy and instant setup and 24/7 customer support, all without any long-term contracts. Be professional, responsive, and efficient with Grasshopper. Get your business phone number today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. That's grasshopper.com/kick. And the FastWorks program that you co-created with GE, the granddaddy of all legacy companies, is one of your big success stories. How did that project start out?
Very inauspiciously. So, you know, GE's going through tremendous management changes like right now. So it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out. But at the time, so you got to go back in time a few years. Lean Startup had just come out, and a few of their executives, you know, approached me at an event and said, "Hey, would you like to, you know, you think this is interesting? Would you come do some work with us?" And I treated them the same as I did most big company people at that time, to say, "Well, I guess if you think that could be helpful, but Mostly I was like, that's not really my department. You're kind of in the wrong department of the store, right? Wrong floor. I do startup things. This is a big company. So and they were like, well, you let us worry about that. You just come give some talks. So, you know, I did some stuff with them, get some talks, work with some of their teams. And at a certain point, they told me, listen, we think this is ready to bring to the attention of the CEO and the top executives. And I said, you know, whatever you say. So they brought me out to this meeting in their legendary Crotonville training facility. If you've never been, it's a remarkable, remarkable place. Very well parodied on 30 Rock a few years ago, for those that recall. And this is the location where they do all their executive training, but it's also where the CEO hosts their annual strategy meeting and everything. So this was the what they call the officers meeting of GE. The CEO and his top roughly 200 reports in the company. It's the most senior meeting you can have at the company. It's a closed 2 or 3 day meeting. They don't very rarely have outsiders present at all. And Beth Comstock, who is now the vice chair, but at the time I think her title was CMO, very forward looking, very innovative executive, had her segment of the meeting, and she had convinced them that they should allow an outsider to come in and present. That was me, come and talk about Lean Startup. So we did that, gave my presentation. I never forget the look on everybody's faces. I'm like, who is this kid from Silicon Valley telling us whatever? And at the end of the session, they say, okay, any questions? I remember you could hear a pin drop. Of course, everyone's looking at the front row where Jeff Immelt, CEO, yeah, is sitting. And there, of course, there's no questions. So he asks his question. Here's his first question he asked. So-and-so, he calls on one of his GMs by name. Your division only makes $500 million a year for GE. How come you're not already doing this? And you could just see, like, all of a sudden there were a lot of questions in the room, and it was like such a bold slap in the face. We are going to do this. He was just very clear. I want to hear why we can't do this. And so we did that session. I answered the questions. I did my best. And then they took me straight from that to the afternoon to do a workshop. ML had picked an individual project to do a workshop with. And I want you to visualize this scene, okay? This is a workshop for a diesel reciprocating platform, a high engineering. This is not a software project, okay? Physical product that's used in drilling and fracking and what they call marine electric, like power generation at sea. It's used in locomotive application. I mean, this is a hardcore piece of physical equipment.
Yeah.
And so they had summoned 3 or 4 people from this team. It was called the Series X, this engine. They brought that team out to Crotonville, and just imagine this poor team summoned to Crotonville to do a workshop with me, the three of them, and like 25 corporate vice presidents in the back of the room just to observe. I mean, it's just a brutal setup for a workshop, and this poor team was under tremendous pressure. What the hell are they supposed to do?
Yeah.
And that's how we started. We just had this conversation. I tell a story in detail in the book about what would we call the leap of faith assumptions for this engine, and what could a minimum viable product look like? And over the course of a couple of hours, we showed how the team themselves, not the outside expert, the team themselves, by changing the questions they were asking and the way that they were framing the goal of their problem, they could get the first experiment done not in 5 years, but in 6 months. So an order of magnitude cycle time improvement of speed to market. And it was such a magical moment because you had several of these vice presidents in the back of the room who had been very skeptical, kind of see the magic with their own eyes. And even one of them who said, I get it now. I'm the problem. I'm the one slowing the company down, and I got to change. And so, you know, we started with that one project, and then we did 4 projects, and then we did 8 projects. And then we started doing them like with a program where every few months we would scale up more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were off to the races. And eventually, now I'm kind of catching up to the story I already told you. Once we had shown that we had a critical mass of success and failure stories, and once we had translated these lean startup principles from an outside abstract framework into Fastworks, a GE-specific inside framework, that gave us enough proof points for the CEO and the top executives to say, okay, now we're ready to deploy this across the whole company. And even though you know, there's a leadership transition and several of the people who are involved in that story are leaving the company, several of the people who have been promoted in the wake of that change are people who are part of that original Fastworks implementation, including the new CEO, the new CFO, the new head of innovation. So, I mean, it really has had a profound impact in the company.
Did you find yourself having to break through a very entrenched corporate culture at GE, or did word from the top break through that for you?
You have no idea the resistance and the level of entrenched belief. And look, the insane, I shouldn't say insane, I just mean intense skepticism. And Look, I was in a lot of rooms, but we used to call it facing the firing squad. Like, we would do these trainings and workshops and stuff. And the first 2 hours of every training, I insisted always, listen, let me go present the theory and just take questions from the audience. Because, like, until we get the objections and the skepticism out in the open, we can't address it. We never get anywhere. And so I just have so much visceral. I've been, you know, hundreds of hours at this point answering questions from people who are generally older and more successful than me, right? Like, people who are at the top of their careers who have had, you know.
They have their 50-year pen.
Right. Like, whatever. They've been there for decades. They know their business more than I ever. So, and they have every reason to be skeptical. And I would say, listen, I embrace your skepticism. You're right to be skeptical. If I'm going to say this is a scientific theory, then don't take my word for it. Let's go run some experiments. Let's go prove if I say we do this, this will happen. You say something different will happen. Wouldn't it be nice to know the truth?
Mm-hmm.
So all those workshops, they were all learning by doing. They were about helping the executives and the middle managers discover the truth for themselves, put the ideas to the test, and learn and grow themselves. And I think if we hadn't taken that approach, we never would have been able to overcome the incredible inertia that any established company, and in fact, any well-run established company has to have those antibodies or it would fall apart.
Yeah, and you suggest that companies should restructure into a portfolio of these smaller startups or small teams. What does that actually do? What's the benefit of that?
Well, you know, Amazon has this concept called a two-pizza team, which is a team no larger than you can feed with two pizzas. And it's like, it's just a tool in their corporate toolbox. Whenever they encounter a problem, they're like, you know what? Let's just throw a two-pizza team at it. It's cheap. It's quick. And then we'll go – like they just have the faith that a small dedicated team of cross-functional professionals will discover things that are hard to figure out through analysis and bureaucracy and executive whatever. And I heard a story about an internal transformation at Amazon. This is now – the story's a little dated, so I won't get into the details of what it was. But it was one of these situations where like – an individual engineer read something online, thought it was a good idea, mentioned it to his manager. Next thing you know, he gets summoned to a meeting with Bezos and his executive committee. This poor engineer is like scared to death, right? You know, and he says, tell me what you think. This is a good idea. He explains, I read this thing. I think it's a good idea. Bezos says, you know, anyone who doesn't think this is a good idea shouldn't work at Amazon. And everyone's like, oh crap. Like, okay, well, that's guess we're doing this. And so instead of like assigning it to some committee to figure out, he's like, you – engineer, you're now in charge of a two-pizza team. Go figure this out and go bring me some pilot projects to show. And they did some initial deployments, and then they came back. And he said, okay, that sounds pretty good, but now show me 10 projects working this new way. And, you know, they sent them out, and they had them do a bunch more stuff. And they said, okay, that's good, but these projects have all been kind of easy. I want to see something in, like, our Christmas fulfillment centers, you know, like something like a high-profile, high-stress, difficult project. They did that. And they said, I want every project now. And it wasn't like, you know, as the experiment proceeded, they were touching more and more and more teams, but the core team working on it was not growing like to become this big bureaucratic thing. It was a series of these small teams. And that's, of course, a success story where the thing actually did go through the S-curve and changed the whole company through the efforts of one really dedicated team. But think about all the projects they've done over the years that don't work out. Like the two-pizza team that's great about it is both the potential for exponential impact and also at the same time the recognition that if we fail, we can fail inexpensively. So like how many people in the press were just raking Amazon over the coals over the failure of the Fire Phone? Anyone remember that?
Right.
You know, they were going to make their own cell phone. It was going to rival the iPhone. It was a complete and total dud. It was like, you know, they cost like $700 and then like a month later it cost like, you know, $100 and it was like 99 cents and then they got rid of it. And you know, people were writing all this bad stuff about them. And I remember reading interviews with Bezos at the time. He's like, yeah, we made a mistake. Like it was a failure. It's my job to make billions of dollars of mistakes in order for us to learn. And if I don't do that, I'm not doing my job. I'm like, first of all, what CEO could admit that?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, many of the people involved with that project went on to create huge category-defining successes for Amazon, like Alexa and the tablet. Oh, I can't remember the name of it right now. So yeah, they failed, but they didn't throw away the learning. They took that learning and they, you know, did the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So you start to build up a portfolio of these experiments. It starts to look financially a lot more like a venture capital firm where you're making a lot of discrete bets than it does a traditional command and control top-down company. And now, of course, some of those bets are going to grow up and become, you know, established lines of business. So it's not like the whole company becomes only startups. It's just that a startup becomes what I call in the book an atomic unit of work, a tool in the toolbox, a certain organizational structure you use when you encounter a specific kind of problem, namely one that has this high uncertainty attached to.
You don't view entrepreneurship as strictly the territory of R&D or new products divisions.
Yes.
But it can be applied up and down the line across the whole organization. What are some of the less, maybe less obvious departments that can implement internal startups and benefit from this more entrepreneurial approach?
I have seen it in the most wacky situations. Yeah. I mean, you would not believe. Now, wacky from my point of view in Silicon Valley. What's so funny about my perspective here is that, like, if I meet a startup that's working on, like, quantum computing or immortality or, you know, it's like something like really like out of science fiction, that's like, that's my day job.
Yeah.
I see that, like, every other startup I meet is working on just, you know, vat-grown meat and just crazy stuff, nuclear power, you know, in a suitcase and just all this amazing stuff. So I'm used to that. To me, what's exotic is like that IT finance project. Like, that's very exotic to me, right? Like, deep sea oil drilling is exotic to me. Hospitals are exotic to me. And then, like, so I'll give you one of my favorite examples. I met with somebody where I was in the legal department, I was in the HR department, and there was a joint project going on between HR and legal. So maybe second bad to IT yeah. and finance, HR and legal. And they were working on the company's union contracts. I'm like, oh my God, every 5 years it was, 6 years, we have to renegotiate this union contract with a very adversarial, you know, union who hates our guts. We hate their guts. It's like very acrimonious negotiation. We do it. You know, we extract concessions from each other. They threaten to strike. We threaten to this. And blah, blah, blah. We eventually get to, you know, an outcome that is okay. But we're always like, God, there's got to be a better way. And I remember talking to them and said, okay, well, let's treat this like a startup. What would that look like? And then first of all, like, what are you talking about? Like, well, who's the customer here? What are we trying to do? And, you know, I said, well, the point ultimately is to serve these employees and help the company grow by having the employees, you know, share in that productivity growth. I said, well, isn't that the same goal that the union has too? And they're like, no, those guys don't want it. I was like, but I hear that you have your concerns about whether they are accurately representing the desires of membership, but isn't that their same goal? Yes, it is. And you talk to the union leadership, and they're like, the management's out to screw. Like, but don't – are we not partners in this? And don't we have the same goal? So what would it look like? I was like, hey, given that you only have to negotiate this contract every 5 years or whatever it is, what do you do in the intervening years? All they would do is, like, build up the ammunition for the – like, there's, like, preparing to fight each other. I said, what if we ran some experiments? Could we take one shop, one factory, and try a temporary different contract and then measure – the effect that has on employees? And they were like, how dare you suggest it? I mean, it's just like such a radical suggestion. But when you really broke it down, they're like, that could work. And just like completely changed their perspective of what we're trying to do. And like, I could tell you that story for all these internal functions, the change management folks, internal reorgs. Don't even get me started on supply chain compliance, the units of companies that interact with regulators. It's not even an insight. It's just my flat observation. I have seen incredible entrepreneurial talent and energy that can be unleashed in the most unlikely places.
Yeah. Are there certain people or positions within a large organization who tend to naturally have more entrepreneurial drive or just really rise up to the challenge given that sort of an environment?
There's no discernible pattern that I've been able to find. And you see that same thing in startup founders too. When Silicon
That's
Valley
true.
Talks about how we're a meritocracy, which is a very loaded concept, has all kinds of very problematic and a lot of ways in which we're not. But what they mean when they say that is good ideas can come from anywhere and you just never know, right? Like when Mark Zuckerberg, you know, like when we saw the movie, there's that famous scene where he comes to his pajamas to meet with a VC. Like he didn't look the part and he wasn't respectful. But they were able to overlook all that to see the underlying reality. And so what I see is that, look, you know, if you know about a normal distribution where just any personality attribute, you take a large sample of the population, there's going to be amazing extreme outliers of that attribute just by the law of large numbers. And that's just true in every function. Like once a company gets a certain size, you just by accident, people, you know, they just become, you know, employees of your company. They didn't do it because they have this incredible entrepreneurial talent, but they just have it. And it's like it's hidden in plain sight because in most organizations, we're much more likely to fire someone for taking initiative than we are to promote them.
True.
So in a lot of organizations, people have to hide that they have this entrepreneurial talent. A lot of internal innovation is done off books, you know, where management doesn't know because they're afraid that management will shut it down. Unfortunately, that's also the same environment where a lot of fraud happens. So it's actually a really bad way to manage innovation. Like we need to get it out into the open.
Now, when you're applying the startup way to government and public policy like this, I would think that startup culture and government bureaucracies probably don't mix very well. How do you overcome that?
It's a very funny thing. So one of my favorite stories in the book is about the rescue of healthcare.gov, which most people, I think, remember when Obamacare was melting down.
Yeah,
this piece
rollout.
Of software was so badly designed, it almost destroyed the Obama presidency. I mean, the stakes could not have been higher. And it's only because of Todd Park and a few other heroes who were all people I had met and worked with in lean startup and government beforehand. That's the only reason I know the story and kind of got to see the behind the scenes. They took these techniques we're talking about and applied them to the rescue and provide this miraculous outcome. But let me rewind the tape to a part of the story most people don't know. What we call healthcare.gov, the thing that melted down, is actually the second healthcare.gov.
Really?
The original healthcare.gov was created right after the law was signed. You remember there was this long delay between when President Obama signed the law and Vice President Biden said it was a BFD, right? Like it was a big deal.
Right.
And then there was this long delay before the actual marketplaces and exchanges got rolled out. And one of those very minor provisions of the law was that the government was to stand up a website to help consumers shop for insurance in the individual market and get certain information that they were going to have mandatory disclosure from insurance companies. And Todd Park was CTO of HHS when this mandate came down, and he decided to pursue it in a very different way than your typical government project. He said he created a small team. I think there were five people on it. He said, okay, you have 90 days to stand up the first version of this website. And the team at first was like, okay, in 90 days, we can have a meeting to create the study proposal to whatever to think about. He's like, no, you don't understand. We're not going to make a plan to do it in 90. It's going to be done 90 days from today. And then if that goes well, if you actually accomplish that, then I'll give you another 90 days after that to iterate it. And the team was like, I don't know if that's even possible. And he found the right people in the organization. He said, go, you got 90 days. And they did it. The first healthcare.gov was created in 90 days. And you know, the first version of it didn't work very well, had all kinds of problems, and there was like customer feedback buttons on every page. So they got immediately into dialogue with citizens, with health insurers, and they started to make it better and better and better. And over the course of several months, they did something that in the health insurance world was considered absolutely impossible. They got health insurance companies started to see it as a source of new business for them. Hey, consumers are here shopping for insurance, and they went to the company and said, listen, you're required by law to disclose XYZ. But the website would be a lot better and more usable for customers, for citizens, if you would give us this extra disclosure voluntarily. And they got the insurance companies to voluntarily give them extra disclosure they didn't have to. It was an amazing thing. I mean, they had this rapid iteration culture, and it was really – a lot of people that worked on that project went on to do great things in the government later. Oh. What's funny to me is that when it came time to replace healthcare.gov with the real healthcare.gov, the government looked at this thing and said, this is a tiny little toy with a small team with no budget. Screw that. Like, shut that down. Now let's get the real serious adults on it. Let's go spend $100 million and have defense contractors build us this bureaucratic piece of junk that doesn't work. So it was like such a culture clash. And after the rescue was when many, many, many of these middle manager bureaucrats in the government got they suddenly realized that doing things the conventional way was actually not the safe way.
Mm-hmm.
If you do things the conventional way, there's a chance it's going to blow up in your face and you're going to be on CNN and you're going to be in Gresham's office. It really changed their willingness to try something new. And that became the opening for the application of a lot of these ideas into basically every agency across the whole government, the creation of things like 18F and the USDS. So yeah, it was really a remarkable transformation I was just a bit player, but it was really amazing to get to witness it.
What kind of policy changes would you like to see to make America an entrepreneur-friendlier environment?
Thank you for asking that question. And it's such an important topic. I devote a chapter of the book to it to say, what would it look like if we actually really wanted to have a pro-entrepreneurship public policy instead of just paying lip service to that? And the first thing I got to say is it's not really about partisan politics. Entrepreneurship is one of these topics that just cuts through our current left-right divide in very funny ways. And I think the reason is because in order to have a pro-growth, pro-entrepreneurship public policy, you have to encourage people to start more companies and to take bigger swings and take more risks. In order to do that, the typical kind of right-leaning view of that would be to say, well, we need to give tax breaks to companies and we got to give, deregulate existing companies. But actually, a lot of those policies wind up just entrenching incumbents. So like, yes, the big companies are very happy to take those subsidies and they'll have to take it. In a lot of cases, they'll use that deregulation and the extra flexibility you give them to suppress new companies from even being formed in the first place. You see that in patents. You see that in a lot of IP-related litigation. And you know, the kind of just general rent seeking and regulatory capture you see in big companies. So then people in left say, aha, see, you know, business is bad. But you're like, well, but hold on. If you want people, like, you know, think about the labor movement I was talking about before. If you want people who have a pro-worker philosophy to become part of management, then you got to encourage people to start companies with those values.
Right.
So I think the key to the paradox is if you want to be an entrepreneurial society, you got to ask yourself, when someone decides to start a company, when they become an entrepreneur for the first time, what were they doing 5 minutes beforehand? What was their previous occupation?
Yeah.
Was it likely that they were a CEO before? Just statistically speaking, yeah. there are those of us who have been done it multiple times, but it's actually quite rare. Statistically speaking, the vast majority of entrepreneurs, like I must be 99%. What were they before? They were a student. They were an ordinary worker. Yeah. They were an immigrant.
Right.
So if you want to have them take a risk, you know, you can't have immigrants living in the shadows and then asking them to become entrepreneurs. That's impossible. But also, if people don't have health insurance and they have dependents, like before the passage of Obamacare, I'm always the guy trying to convince people to leave their job and start a company. I used to hear all the time, I can't do it. I got kids. I got an ailing parent. You know, I can't afford to put our health care at risk. And of course, my entrepreneurial colleagues in a lot of other countries would be like, that's a really dumb reason to like not allow people to start a company. And one of my favorite studies on the subject ever, I think it was by the Rand Corporation. They had this incredible study where they looked at entrepreneurship, new business formation rates by age cohort. And, you know, they look at every age that you can be every year and figure out what's the percentage of them that start a company. And in the United States, when people go from being 64 to 65, there's a step change increase in the rate at which they start new companies.
That is completely counterintuitive.
Makes no sense. Like in general, entrepreneurship rates decline as people become elderly and retire. So why would it go up? Like, and what, 65-year-olds are more creative than 64-year-olds? No. 65-year-olds become eligible for Medicare. So all of a sudden, people who were trapped in their crappy job because they couldn't – it's like so clear in the data.
Interesting.
So now – you know, and I've had this problem where you're like, so is Obamacare a liberal or a conservative issue? Well, like, I was actually on Fox when my book came out. I did a little tour. I was on Fox. I remember a segment they said, isn't Obamacare job-destroying? I said, listen, with all due respect, it's – I don't know. You can argue about all kinds of aspects of it, but one thing is unarguable. This is going to have a very positive rate for entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
So is that a – left issue or a right issue? Like, it gets confusing. And you see that with immigration. You see that with protections for companies. Like, take a simple one. California has a policy that you cannot enforce non-compete agreements. Non-compete agreements are terrible. They should not be allowed. Well, from a more libertarian point of view, you might say, well, all contracts should be allowed, should be enforced. And people should be able to voluntarily contract whatever they want. But in real life, people sign these contracts so they don't have power with their employers, and employers use it not to protect trade secrets, but honestly, in a lot of cases, just to prevent their former employees from starting companies at all.
Yeah.
So that's like a very simple policy change that every state in the union should follow California. I think we've proven that our model works pretty well. So anyway, so there's just a bunch of these things where we have to take this seriously. We are so complacent that America is world headquarters for innovation, the best place in the world to start a company, but there are a lot of countries hot on our trail and a lot of startup hubs around the world trying to rival Silicon Valley. And my view is, in the modern economy, as a consumer, it doesn't really matter to me where companies are started. Like, a common thing we do in this country that makes no sense is we take like a PhD student who's been in the country for 12 years pursuing an advanced degree from another country. As soon as they say, I'm ready to leave my PhD program and start a company, we're like, get the heck out of here. We kick them out of the country, make
insane.
Them go start the company in their home. After we've invested all this time in it. Well, as a consumer, if they go start Angry Birds or Nokia or whatever in their home country, I still get to play Angry Birds. So it doesn't really matter to me. If you look at the VCs who fund innovation, capital is very portable across borders. So their regional VC fund or wherever, like as a rich person, you can still benefit from the – but the jobs that are created, the spillover economic effects – happen wherever the company is headquartered. So why wouldn't we want to say we want the absolute best and the brightest in the world to start their company in the United States? We want to be the most pro-entrepreneurship country that you can be. And all the research that's been done suggests that's key to economic growth in the future. So it's a kind of grow the pie mentality that I think we cannot take for granted. We have to actively work as a community to invest in our civic institutions to preserve.
Yeah, I hope I have this right, but I think that you say in the book that 40% of the CEOs in Silicon Valley or something like that are immigrants themselves.
It's
right?
a remarkable stat that I'm sure I'll get it wrong, so people should. I'm sure I cite it correctly
if
in the book, but exactly. Who knows? It's a very high percentage of the most impactful companies had an immigrant co-founder, I think,
wow.
is a stat. And it's – we just take it for granted that, of course,
Sergey
it's that
Brin
way.
And
you know, Max Levchin and all mm-hmm. these very famous examples. Steve Jobs was the son of a Syrian immigrant. I mean
– right.
So do we want Steve Jobs to start his company here or somewhere else? It's like that. It's like that basic to me. And anyone who would say, like, that's not the American way – you know, my grandparents were immigrants to this country. It's like the most American thing there is, I think, to seek out the land of opportunity and to say that we are a country defined not by our blood, not by our soil, but by our ideas. Mm-hmm. And to say if you believe in the civic religion of this country, then you are an American, the same as George Washington or anybody. Anyone who doesn't agree with that, I just can't understand.
Well, before we go, when you're consulting with GE or when you're lecturing a group of young startup wannabes, do you have a favorite mantra that you like to drive home?
Oh, sure. It's this very simple phrase. And I wish I could give credit. It was not my original invention, but I cannot remember where I learned it first. It's kind of ubiquitous in startup circles. And it's just three things. One, think big. Two, start small. Three, scale fast. So like when in doubt, just do those three things. Like take your big idea. Like if you don't have a big idea, work on that first. Like think about, like people always talk about changing the world, but like take it seriously. Like if I could change the world right now, whoever you're listening to me right now, I bet you have a 100% unique perspective on how the world could and should be changed. So what is it? Like give yourself permission just for a minute, think big. Now, once you have that idea, don't go crazy being like, I gotta write a 400-page business plan and I'm not qualified. Who knows? Just be like, just Mark Zuckerberg this thing, okay? Like start with something really small. Be like, what is the smallest possible way I could put my foot in the water of this? And don't make it like, well, how do I get more education or more training? Just like, what if you actually just started working on the thing itself? What would happen? And then as you start to run these experiments, you should ask yourself, what's the kind of experiment that could scale fast? And of course, I mean, the reason I write books about this topic and we don't just teach this like in 5 seconds on the radio is like there's a lot of art and skill and there's a lot of tools you can learn about how to measure the leading indicators of future growth, how to think about a business model so that you can have exponential growth. But like worry about all that stuff after you've already got your feet wet and you're already trying it and you're already doing it and just run that experiment. You know, if you're hearing this message on a Friday, run the experiment on Monday. Come up with an experiment that you could do end to end on Monday. Everyone listening can afford one day to mess around with these ideas. Just try it, you know, tomorrow, next week. Don't do this months from now, one day after you've already graduated, after you already got this or that, or after you're already rich and famous. Like, just start right now. Like, just get started and don't put your life savings into it. Just do an experiment you can afford to have fail and just see what happens.
All right. Well, let's see. Think big.
Start small. Scale fast.
Scale fast.
Think
and when
big,
you've hit it
small,
big, hire
fast.
Eric as your consultant and pay him very, very well.
I would rather you don't hire me at all. You write a book about what you learned that I got all wrong and teach me something. That's the reward I would like.
Okay. Well, again, the book is called The Startup Way, How Modern Companies Use Entrepreneurial Management to Transform Culture and Drive Long-Term Growth. Eric, thanks for talking with me.
It was really a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Eric Ries for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, The Startup Way, on Amazon or download the audio version on Audible. You can follow him on Twitter at Eric Ries and check out his website for more information at theleanstartup.com. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kickass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kickass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.